Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are bringing our focus to one of the most exciting and emerging areas of nutrition science, gut health. We all have an understanding of how our genetics and lifestyle choices can determine our health. However, in recent years, much attention has been given to how the foods we eat, activity we do, and lives we lead can alter the bacteria in our gut, which can have a profound effect on both our physical and mental health. To help us explore this topic, I've invited some of the world's top researchers and practitioners in this space to help us better understand how to optimize our gut health. Today, our guest is Dr. Gabrielle Fundero. Dr. Fundero has a PhD in human nutrition, food, and exercise from Virginia Tech. She is a Monash Low FODMAP certified and ISSN certified sport nutritionist and ACE certified health coach. When working with individuals experiencing gastric distress, Dr. Fundero applies a practical, personalized, and evidence-based approach to modify diet and lifestyle factors which can contribute to improved digestive comfort. She has taught a variety of courses related to nutrition for performance and health, physiology, and macronutrient metabolism. In this episode, we discuss common myths in regards to the microbiome, what dietary patterns seem to be favorable for good gut health, why to show caution when reading science on social media, and we discuss the science behind fecal transplants. There's a lot to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. So season four, we are running our gut health series. Now today we are joined by a very special guest. We've got Dr. Gabrielle Fundero joining us. Doctor, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to come on and talk about poop and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll get right into all of that. But before we do, Doctor, can you give us a bit of a background on yourself and how you came to be working in this area?
Absolutely. So I actually have my my beginnings in exercise science. So my bachelor's is in exercise science. I knew that I wanted to become a professor from a fairly young age. And so I went on to pursue my PhD actually in the area of skeletal muscle metabolism. And so I was originally studying the effects of high fat feeding on muscle hypertrophy. And I entered the realm of the gut microbiome because I'm just super curious and I want to get to the bottom of things. One of the interventions or one of the treatments that we would apply to our rodent models and sometimes our humans would be an injection of lipopolysaccharide or LPS. So that is an endotoxin that comes from the gut. It comes from some of the bacteria in the gut. And when it binds to certain receptors in our immune system, it can cause an immune response, an inflammatory response. And so I thought, well, why aren't we kind of getting to the bottom of it and looking in the gut? If that's where this is coming from, maybe we should look there instead of looking at, you know, how do we prevent it from exiting the gut or how do we modulate it once it gets out into circulation? So my side project was looking at the potential protective effects of probiotics during high fat feeding and could perhaps probiotics offer some protection against the metabolic dysregulation that comes with high fat overfeeding. And through a series of sort of unfortunate events, my main project was canned because we lost all of the samples that we needed. And so my side project on probiotics then became my main project. And so I worked on that for quite some time, multiple iterations of rodent models, and we did a subsequent human study as well. And some of the collaborations I did too with other labs, because I was pretty good at animal husbandry, looked at various compounds and polyphenols and how they might modulate things like intestinal permeability or insulin sensitivity via the microbiome. I didn't have any intention on staying in that area or doing anything with it. It was really just I wanted to get my PhD so I could teach. And so I went on to teach for 4 years in sport nutrition and exercise science. And I taught anatomy and physiology, but I didn't really do much even with the digestive system in those semesters. So I ended up in this area because in my last year of teaching, Dr. Mike from Renaissance Periodization found me, recruited me to RP. I was an RP coach for that year. And then I decided that I wanted to leave academia to continue coaching full time. And at that point, we had a discussion about, you know, the opportunity for me to speak about the gut microbiome and provide some evidence-based education and recommendations and kind of bust some of the myths that were rapidly growing because this is such a new, you know, burgeoning area. And so that's where it started. I went on with Revive Stronger. Steve was my first gut health podcast. And from there, I think it was really just kind of a snowball effect that I don't know if it was just like, you know, coincidental or like having, you know, more podcasts about it really started to accelerate, you know, and pick up momentum. But yeah, so here I am now, like I'm on podcasts quite a lot about, you know, talking about this area. So I'm glad that I had that experience, that I have the research experience, and, you know, I'm able to kind of still collaborate with the academic side of things and, you know, then bring things to kind of the public sector and help people navigate the area.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Before we get into the gut health doctor, I know you said your previous PhD got canned due to the funding. Can you give anything away? What were you guys starting to find in the results when you were looking at the high fat feeding with skeletal muscle?
Well, it wasn't even a funding thing. It was just that. So we went through two cohorts of rodents. So I worked on this for, I want to say, about 6 months. And we had stored the skeletal muscle samples in a buffer that helps to preserve the RNA. So basically the, you know, for people that aren't familiar, that's basically what we use. It's the instructions to make a protein. And when we stored it to be able to measure the levels of RNA, because that's how you can determine like what can this, like what cells in this, what the cells in this muscle, what could they potentially create? What type of proteins and to what extent? Like what's the magnitude of protein production? But the, you know, we sometimes you work with undergrads and whatnot, and sometimes, you know, they don't follow instructions. And so they had put them, they put the samples in wet, you know, not frozen, just in a baggie, and put them in the freezer. And I went into the freezer a couple days later and all the buffer had come out and like wiped off all of the, you know, all the labels were gone. We had no idea. So I was crushed because it's very rare for a project to go off like without a hitch, you know, like didn't lose any mice, like everything came out really well. Data, like the sample collection was super clean. And so yeah, that it was very stressful. It was such a disappointment, but it was based on, so we didn't find anything in that study because we didn't have the opportunity to, but it was based on previous research that implied that a high fat diet could potentially suppress mTOR signaling, thereby suppressing skeletal muscle hypertrophy. And so it was kind of, they were looking at this as sort of parallel to the cachexia that we see in cancer muscle wasting or sarcopenia muscle wasting in old age. So they were kind of looking at that as, you know, a potential mechanism that, you know, perhaps high fat feeding or high fat feeding with overfeeding and or westernized style diet, because we kind of use those all interchangeably. You know, ketogenic diet is also high fat, but it's not necessarily the same as a westernized diet, which is high fat, high refined carbs. So yeah, it was a sad, sad story, but hey, I'm glad because look at where I am today.
Blessing in disguise. Hey, I'll come out and admit that I was once in a biochemistry lab when I was an undergrad and I sneezed on one of our petri dishes and didn't tell anyone. And then it got all sorts of strange results. And I'd never ever confessed. And I played dumb. So undergraduates, yeah, I remember also ruining many projects as an undergrad. So must be worldwide. But let's get into gut health. Let's go in. You spoke about the myths. When you came on, you started, it was a lot about like the myth busting, and gut health has just grown. It's grown so rapidly in the last couple of years. There's research everywhere. You must see this a lot. You must look at this and go, oh, that's not completely true, or that's not completely true. Are there certain things that you see more often than not? Are there, say, two or three or four things that are these bigger myths that you should, that people at home should be aware of, that aren't completely true?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, there are so many. And I think like the topic of gut health being sort of the Instagram version of gut microbiome science, that is growing more rapidly and with more undue confidence than the field of microbiome science itself. You know, we publish an article and it's so funny because I attend a lot of, I attended when things were open, I attended, you know, so many of these gut microbiome science conferences. So researchers are presenting their findings and I went to represent like hey, I'm an ex-academic and I live in Instagram world now. And here's what people are thinking. And like the disconnect was so great that they were just incredulous about some of the things that people are saying on the internet, you know? So I think that's one of the biggest things. Maybe that's one of the biggest kind of myths, that people think that what they see on Instagram is representative of what's going on, you know, in the field. And that can happen even if a person is, you know, potentially referencing an article. Just because a person has referenced an article, that doesn't mean that is a reproducible article, or that, you know, those findings are truly valid to what kind of message that person is sending. So, you know, we have to be kind of careful about just believing something because it's an article. And I've seen even, you know, medical practitioners sort of misrepresent findings in sort of absolutist ways to like support their message. They might have like a dogmatic belief about something. So I think that that's one of the big disconnects. The other would be, you know, that there is an ideal diet for gut health. And it's everyone thinks that, oh, it's a vegan diet, or it's a keto diet, or it's a carnivore diet, or it's a paleo diet. You can't eat grains, or you can't eat animal proteins. And when you look at the totality of evidence, there's no way that we can make a claim like that, because the inter-individual variability of gut microbiomes from one person to the next is so great, it actually kind of clouds the resolution with which we can really parse out the differences. So we have this problem of heterogeneity in the literature between methodology, between individuals, between dietary controls, to the point that you can look at one study that says vegans have higher bacteroides and another study that says vegans have lower bacteroides. Well, then what is the consensus? You know, we have such a paucity of data and it's so heterogeneous that it's like we can't really say with any certainty, you know, that one diet is best. So that's another big myth. Another one that I find to be very pervasive, kind of two sides of the same coin, the idea of there being a gut reset and the idea of there being a gut detox or cleanse. You know, there's no, you would not want to remove all of the bacteria and microorganisms in your gut. That would be problematic for a number of reasons. They provide us with nutrients, pathogen resistance, they interact with our immune system. So that would be very problematic. We can't pick and choose which microbes change in response to our interventions, whatever we're doing. And then the idea of the third thing would be the idea of a healthy versus an unhealthy gut. So people say, I have bad gut health, or I want to improve my gut health. Just the term gut health in itself is actually meaningless. And the term dysbiosis, which people mostly use to be analogous for an unhealthy gut, actually just means altered compared to the controls. Doesn't mean unhealthy, it just means different. So those are these huge myths that there's so many different moving parts to each one of those, that they give rise to all sorts of other kind of mini myths and supplements and you know, protocols and a lot of marketing opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good way to put it. Marketing opportunities. I think that's a nice way to put it, to be honest. Hey, doctor, can we start talking about I think it's become very clear over at least in my experience with this podcast, that every expert's come on that there's no consensus on what the best diet is for gut health, but there does seem to be certain foods or certain ways of eating that are more conducive to getting more favorable bacteria. Can you talk to us a little bit about that in your experience and in what's in the literature?
Yeah. So I think that we could say that there are more beneficial and healthful dietary patterns. That's probably a more accurate representation rather than thinking of a specific diet. And it looks like the most beneficial dietary patterns, I think we have to back up for a second and say, like, what is beneficial? Like, how do we know that what we're doing is causing a beneficial change in the gut? Because we can change how the microbiome looks through a variety of means, but all change isn't necessarily good change. And on the other side of things, some change, we don't really know whether it's kind of good or not. We don't know what the clinical outcomes might be. But generally speaking, when we're talking about gut health, we might want to look at, you know, disease risk. So the risk of colorectal cancer, we might want to look at, you know, perhaps like symptoms of gastrointestinal distress. And that can be, you know, caused by diet without any sort of disease present. And we might also look at the diversity of the gut microbiome. So diversity is generally referring to the number of species that are present and then their relative abundance. So we have some species that are potentially pathogenic, so they could potentially cause disease if they get to a high enough relative abundance. We have some that could potentially be beneficial to us because they're producing perhaps short-chain fatty acids that have a known beneficial effect, like butyrate, or maybe they're modulating the immune activity in the GI tract, or maybe they help to control the growth of pathogens. And then there might be some species that don't seem to do anything, but just their presence might help to suppress the growth of the potential pathogens. So we can look at, you know, does the diet support sort of microbial diversity? So we look at those few things, you know, so kind of the looking at the gut, the gastrointestinal tract is separate from the gut microbiome, but they interact with one another. And I think gut health is sort of an all-encompassing thing. Then in most cases, what seems to be most supportive is a variety of plant matter in the diet. So a variety of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and legumes. Now that's because those foods are high in microbe-accessible carbohydrates. So those carbohydrates are indigestible to humans. So that means they pass through the small intestine and they reach the large intestine where they can be fermented by the bacteria there. And those bacteria are using them as an energy source. They're perhaps also producing some of the beneficial short-chain fatty acids that I mentioned. And those can be an energy source for our intestinal cells and for us as well. And the production of those short-chain fatty acids also helps to regulate pH, which can help in turn suppress some of the growth of those pathogenic bacteria. It also prevents the bacteria from turning on our mucus layer, which contains the carbohydrates that they could use as an alternative source of energy if they don't have the microbe-accessible carbohydrates. So that's why we want to get those in the diet. So then people might think, okay, well, vegan is clearly superior. Not necessarily the case, because it doesn't look like there's a deleterious effect of having a prudent amount of animal protein in the diet either. Now, the fermentation of some of the amino acids in animal proteins can give rise to some potentially carcinogenic or harmful compounds like hydrogen sulfide, TMAO. So there is a link there, but it doesn't mean that like any amount of animal protein is going to be problematic. Again, we have to look at sort of the relative dose and the backdrop of the diet. There are also some animal-based products that might be beneficial, like low-fat dairy and whey. So the lactose can actually be bifidogenic and actually be sort of it's a prebiotic, it's fermentable. And then when we're looking at whey protein, that's also another one that's been shown to potentially be bifidogenic, and bifidobacteria are considered a beneficial strain, so or a beneficial species. So when we are, you know, looking at the dietary pattern, we can start to see these trends emerge that most of the time people have a greater microbial diversity if they're eating a wide variety of plants in the diet and if they're getting in a lot of carbohydrates, especially complex carbohydrates. Not to say that animal proteins are problematic. There have been a relatively small number of studies that looks at the effects of fat on the microbiome. And it looks like if we look at sort of the contribution of fat as a percentage, if we get above about 40% of our calories from fat, we start to see a reduction in diversity, perhaps because that means that now we're eating fewer carbohydrates because we're having higher fat in the diet. We don't really have a clear picture on which types of fats are consistently more beneficial, or they're only like omega-3s versus omega-6s versus saturated fat. So that really kind of needs to be cleared up. But that's kind of like the, you know, general gist is, okay, eat maybe a moderate fat intake, a variety of plants, adequate fiber, you know, 25 grams to 38 grams per day from a variety of sources. You can have animal proteins, you don't have to have them. It doesn't look like there's a huge benefit either way, as long as you're not eating them at the detriment of then getting adequate microbe accessible carbohydrates. So you could do that with an omnivorous diet. You could potentially do that with, you could do that with a vegan diet. Potentially with a ketogenic diet, it gets a little bit more challenging there because now are you really getting enough of the soluble fiber, which we're finding more in like fruits and grains. Those are the fermentable fibers. And as we start to really decrease our plant intake, that's when we start to kind of run into problems. So I could say that while we don't have like a best diet, quote unquote, for gut health, there are a couple practices that are pretty popular right now that we are seeing that we have. We don't have long-term studies on, you know, the diet that I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, but we have studies on the ketogenic diet and on fully animal-based diets that do show reproducible results, a loss in diversity, loss of bifidobacteria, and thinning of that mucus layer.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that just keeps coming up and it's pretty obviously from what you just said is that fiber plays a pretty big role in all of this. No matter what type of eating pattern or dietary regime you're following, fiber seems to be very important. Why is that? Why is fiber so important to this gut?
Yeah, and it's especially the insoluble, or excuse me, it's especially the soluble fiber. So insoluble fiber, we kind of think of that as the stuff that stays, that maintains its structure even in water. So it's not water soluble, it's usually structural, something like cellulose. It's very, you know, firm and maybe stringy, like if you're thinking about like celery or the skins of fruits and vegetables. You have a lot of cellulose there. It's not highly fermentable. It does help to create bulk in the stool, but it's not a readily available energy source for those microbes. So we want to focus more on getting a wide variety of different soluble fibers. So these are the fermentable fibers. And it's actually not just fiber. We can also look at resistant starch. So that's a different chemical structure from a fiber, but it still is resistant to our digestive enzymes. And then we can also look at things like sugar, alcohols. Those are also considered to be prebiotic. And then lactose, as I mentioned. So anything that might pass through our small intestine and get to the large intestine where it can be used as an energy source for microbes, that's going to be hugely beneficial for them. And we want a variety because at this point, we don't know which microbes like which fibers most. There have been studies and they're kind of like, well, gosh, we don't know. And part of the problem there is that we don't have just a linear relationship. It's not just a one way, like this fiber feeds this bacteria and that's a discrete system. It's not like that. It's that this fiber might feed this bacteria and then this bacteria creates maybe a byproduct that feeds this other bacteria or suppresses the growth of this other bacteria. So then we can't make the mistake of saying this fiber causes, you know, the growth of this secondary bacteria. We don't actually know what it is, but depending on how we're analyzing the changes, it'd be very difficult to kind of parse out, you know, a potential cause and effect relationship, which is why we really don't have any yet. We just have correlations and we have sort of, you know, educated recommendations based on what we're seeing. And so I think it makes sense to just say like, hey, we're not quite sure. So just eat a wide variety because you have a wide variety of microbes in the gut. You have a wide, when we are looking at the differences in bacterial strains or subspecies, it's like looking at the differences between the way a dog versus a dingo acts. I mean, that's huge. You know, they look kind of similar, but like if you want a family pet, you want a dog, even though they're genetically very similar. It's the same thing when we're looking at subspecies of bacteria. The difference is that we're looking at potentially thousands of subspecies that all have kind of unique personalities and they're interacting with one another and they're interacting with other microbes in the gut because it's not just bacteria and they're interacting with our intestinal cells. So it's a little bit too complex to say like, oh, just eat this one thing, you know, this one thing, five top foods for gut health or whatever. We're really just picking, sometimes we'll pick out different foods from a dietary pattern. Like, oh, walnuts were really popular, you know, like fermented dairy and things like that. So it's great to include those things, but, you know, don't make the mistake of thinking that it's a gut health superfood.
Hey guys, I just wanted to jump in here and it'll be quick. I know, I'm not a fan of ads either, but this isn't an ad. Well, it is, but I literally get nothing out of doing this. I just want to give a shout out to some of the businesses that have helped and continue to help me along my journey. Before You Speak is quite possibly one of the fastest growing coffee brands coming out of Australia. To be quite honest, I'm a bit of a coffee snob, and these guys have absolutely ruined coffee for me. I literally cannot drink anything else. As a matter of fact, one of my UFC fighters loves it so much that when we were cutting weight for one of his fights, he made me factor in the weight of a before you speak coffee so he could have it the morning before he weighed in. That's a true story, and I have a video of it on my Instagram. This stuff is legit, and if you want to try it, they have been kind enough to do a discount code for my listeners. Just head to their website and enter TFD10 to receive a 10% discount. All right, back to the podcast.
Yeah, I like that. And we mentioned it just then. You kind of touched on the sugar alcohols, and I want to ask you about the effect that artificial sweeteners and sugar alcohols, what's the research leaning towards right now in the effect that they have or the potential effect they have on our gut health?
So I think people would probably be surprised to learn that sugar alcohols, with the exception of erythritol, are actually considered prebiotic. That means they're energy sources for the bacteria. So do they have an effect? Almost definitely. Not necessarily a deleterious effect, not necessarily a damaging effect. I mean, this is an energy source for them. The problem is that they quite often have a laxative effect for us and lead to the production of a lot of gases. So when we consume too many sugar alcohols, we might get the runs, we might get painful cramping and gas and bloating and like really smelly gas and think, this must be really bad for my gut health. Not necessarily. It's just that when those microbes are doing the things that microbes do, they might be producing byproducts that make us feel uncomfortable. And that's part of the reason I think why people are a little bit hesitant around eating more fiber and around including those FODMAPs, those specific fermentable carbohydrates, because their structure causes them to be highly fermentable, creating gas and osmotic, meaning they pull water into the intestine. So we get these symptoms that we think are indicative of kind of bad gut health, but not necessarily. And in fact, if we're looking at, you know, markers of potential, you know, bad gut health, like if we're thinking like dysbiosis, you really wouldn't have outward symptoms of that, you know, unless you have like a C. diff infection. But the fact that you have gas and bloating and things, that doesn't necessarily mean there's anything wrong with your microbiome. Now, when we look at the effects of artificial sweeteners, which are different, you know, sugar alcohols are naturally occurring. And then we have artificial sweeteners, which are non-nutritive, sort of, you know, I want to say like made in a lab, and people are like, but I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I just mean that like literally, you know, they're just not something that we would necessarily find in nature. In most cases, and I say that with, you know, most cases being very few cases, because we have very few well-controlled human trials. We got a lot looking at cell culture, and it looks like everything can be poison in cell culture. And you know what? You can kill those things on accident. I can tell you how many times I've cultured skeletal muscle cells and they're like, good to go one day. And then the next day they're just dead for no reason. Like, it's so frustrating. But you can induce, you know, some significant effects and inflammatory cascades in cells very easily, but it's not really physiologically relevant to humans. So the next step would be potentially a rodent model, and we still run into the same issues there, that we aren't dosing them with human equivalent doses. If you give a rodent 1 mg/kg of something, it's not equivalent to 1 mg/kg in a human. It actually even depends on the type of rodent, rats versus mice versus hamsters or guinea pigs. It's all going to be different. So we can't necessarily extrapolate that either. And then if we're looking in a human study, well, we have to make sure that we're using a control group, of course, and some studies actually don't. They'll just take like the responders and then like do a fecal transplant into mice and be like, oh my gosh, you know, look at this magnitude of effect. And then it's not reproducible. And so that kind of happened classically this past year. There was a study done with, you know, looking at insulin resistance in the last couple of years using fecal microbiome transplant into rodents. And they weren't able to recapitulate those findings. So we have to make sure that it's reproducible. So that's my little tirade to say, like, we have relatively little human data that's well controlled. What we have seen so far is that there's really not much in the way of changes to hormone signaling in the gut. There's really not much in the way of changes to the microbiome, especially with aspartame. That's the one that we've got, I want to say, 3 to 4 human studies looking at changes to the microbiome. Really nothing. And we've got the same thing with sucralose. Not really, no changes to the microbiome itself, which makes sense, because if we're thinking about, okay, how do we cause changes to the microbiome? Well, we have to kind of either feed them or deprive them of a nutrient. That's usually one way. We can give them potentially a drug that they might be able to metabolize, or one that will kill them. That's another way. If we're putting in a compound that to them is sort of inert, they can't do anything with it, they probably won't interact with it. So it makes sense that we wouldn't really see changes. So in terms of, you know, gut microbiome, assuming that you're staying within the accepted, you know, acceptable daily intake range, which is a lot. You know, if you're drinking more than 13 or so cans of soda a day, that could potentially be problematic. But then I think you might want to look at the rest of your dietary pattern and see how are you drinking 13 cans of soda, of diet soda a day. So just, you know, keeping those things in mind, that it really is also about the dose. You know, and also that we have kind of a lot of wiggle room in there, because we established that ADI with a huge safety buffer based on what we've seen.
Yeah. 13 cans of soda, I think, would mean a lot of trips to the toilet as well. So,
we
touched on it just then. Doctor, you spoke about the fecal microbiome transplant. So I guess we're getting to the point of the podcast where we're going to start talking about poo.
Yeah.
can you tell us, what is a fecal microbiome transplant? What's the theory behind it?
Yeah. So fecal microbiome transplant is just how it sounds. We're taking the fecal microbiome from a donor. So we're taking feces, which contains those live microbes, and we are transplanting it into a recipient that may be through enemas. It may be through the oral route, encapsulated. So this was something that was done in rodents to help reproduce symptoms or the phenotype of the donor. The donor could have been another rodent, or it may have been a human. And we can fairly consistently reproduce at least some of the metabolic or physical phenotype of the donor when we transplant into a rodent. So this was kind of famously done with the Gordon and Turnbaugh group. They transplanted the microbiome from an obese mouse, it was genetically obese, into a germ-free mouse. That means a mouse that had no gut bacteria. And the germ-free mice became obese quite rapidly, either through an increase in food intake, which makes sense, or an increase in energy harvesting. So that means that the microbiome was able to extract more energy from the diet than the host itself was able to extract. And they do that because when they ferment those fibers to short-chain fatty acids, they take something that's indigestible to humans and they turn it into something that is digestible and energy dense, because those are fats. So we get actually some energy from those. And they've done that then with some disease states as well. So they can potentially, you know, see changes in insulin sensitivity. They might be able to reproduce some symptoms of gastrointestinal disease. They have even seen some changes in behavior in rodents that have received transplants from individuals with, you know, behavioral differences. That's not to say that what they can do in rodents then is translatable to humans. And it really doesn't appear to be the case. So where we've seen great effects, huge benefits with FMT is with C. diff. So in patients who have C. difficile infection, which is a really common hospital-borne infection, or people commonly get it also if they're taking strong antibiotics, those antibiotics kill off so many of the neutral and beneficial bacteria that it gives rise to blooms of C. diff, which is highly pathogenic. And so when they do an FMT in those folks, the C. diff is cured almost immediately. So much better than using antibiotics, and doesn't seem to recur either. And it's so effective that actually when they were doing these human trials, they had to kind of stop the trial because it was unethical to continue and not give treatment to the control group. So hugely effective for C. diff. So of course we think, oh my gosh, this must be effective for everything else, for inflammatory bowel diseases and IBS, and potentially, you know, if we can make a lean mouse obese, can we then make individuals who are obese, can we help them lose weight? Can we use this in a weight management fashion? And the answer to that so far is no. And in fact, we might actually make IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, worse in some cases. So if you have Crohn's or colitis and you go in for FMT, yeah, it could actually cause a flare. You may end up contracting a disease that you didn't have before. So, you know, they do, you know, screen the donors and they process the samples and whatnot, but there, it might be that your immune system has never been exposed to the microbe that was native in someone else's gut, and then you have a problem. So it's something that's still experimental and is probably going to be experimental for a very long time, and so far just doesn't seem to be panning out in the way that I think many people were hopeful about. It really seemed, you know, with the rodent models that this had a lot of potential, and it just is not, you know, it hasn't helped with metabolic syndrome or with weight management. That's kind of where we are now.
Okay, so don't necessarily rush to buy your poo transplant just yet.
Yeah, exactly. Don't pull the South Park with the, isn't it like, I can't remember, was it like Tim Tebow who they're trying to like get his gut microbiome transplant? I don't know. People, I've yet to see the episode, but lots of people have sent me clips, so I probably should watch it.
Yeah, too good. All right, Doctor, I'm very mindful of time here. So last question that I want to ask you is, where do you see this going? Where do you see in the next couple of years, what are going to be the big areas in gut health and what are some things we should be looking out for?
There are definitely going to be studies looking at changes to the gut microbiome in response to resistance training. That's an area that is as yet pretty much just unexplored. There was one study looking at the correlation between like fat intake and diversity in bodybuilders, and that was about it. So most of what we know, quote unquote, about the gut microbiome of an athletic population is in endurance athletes or people who are just recreationally active and you know, meeting recommendations for exercise versus those who aren't. So I know that that's happening because I'm collaborating with one, and I know of some other labs that are doing it. So that's going to be coming out, you know, in the next several years. I'm sure that's going to be emerging, and that's super exciting. I think that we probably are also going to see, because there's been kind of a call to action in that field of research to create more homogeneous methods and more standardization and reproduction of methods, that hopefully we're going to see a little bit more, you know, some streamlining and some either reproductions or some contradictions to previous findings. And I think we're also going to start to see like what are the things that we don't yet know are causing problems in our data. You know, that's always something that comes to light later down the line. We say like, oh man, you know, we actually had, you know, the rodent food. There was one that came out of the Gordon lab. They found that part of the change to the microbiome that they were seeing was based on contamination of the food that, you know, that was being used by a variety of different labs. So even the lab itself has a significant effect on the baseline microbiome. So really, I think just improvements in the science itself and you know, potentially more effective applications of things like probiotics and FMT as the science and the methods improve.
Excellent. Well, Doctor, thanks so much for taking the time. Just lastly, if people are listening to the episode and they want to shoot you a message or they want to follow your work or they want to get in contact with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, or if they want to fight me about the carnivore diet. So they can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Vitamin PhD. I also have a website, vitaminphdnutrition.com, and they can shoot me an email, vitaminphdnutrition@gmail.com. And they can DM me too. I answer all DMs on Instagram unless I accidentally delete them. And for those that I've done that to, I'm really sorry.
All right, Dr. Fundera, thank you so much for taking time. I know you're super, super busy at the moment, but I really appreciate you coming on and thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Dr. Fundera brings an extremely balanced, objective, and scientific approach to her views on gut health. As she says, there is so much data right now that it is nearly impossible to say what exactly is the best diet for good gut health. But we can definitely start looking at the patterns to make solid recommendations. Be sure to keep up with her on socials to stay up to date with her work. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast.
If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.